bridging the gap between the Earth and the Moon. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. We're dedicating this whole episode to our moon, and we'll start here at home, at a lab at the Florida Space Institute. One team is making artificial moon dust to help engineers here on Earth plan for future lunar missions. We'll speak with University of Central Florida's Dan Britt about how he replicates the moon's environment in his lab. Then we'll speak with veteran NASA astronaut Nicole Stott about her friendship with Apollo moonwalker Alan Bean and how he brought the moon to his art. And finally, we check in with Firefly Aerospace about its upcoming missions to the moon's South Pole. Kevin Schulte joins us to tell us what awaits the company's lander, Blue Ghost. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Well, we can't go to the moon every day. There are ways to create the moon's environment here on Earth. Kind of. At Florida Space Institute's Regolith Lab in Orlando, scientists study and recreate lunar, Martian, and asteroid regolith, or another word for dirt. So what does it take to make moon dust, and why make it in the first place? Our intern Ashley Reap spoke with Dan Britt, a Pegasus professor of physics at the University of Central Florida and director of the Exolith Lab, about that moon dust and what it's like making 2 to 3 tons of synthetic lunar dirt a week. Here's that conversation now.
I'm Dr. Daniel Britt. I'm a Pegasus professor of physics at the University of Central Florida. I'm the director of the Exolith Lab, and I actually do very little because almost all of it is run by UCF students.
Can you tell me a little bit about when you started this lab?
We started it back about 8 years ago. The idea was that we were developing simulants for regolith surfaces across the solar system, so Mars, the moon, asteroids. And this is to enable people to better design exploration hardware to explore safer, cheaper, more effectively.
What is it about moon dust that fascinates you?
Well, it just is. It is what happens when you're in an entirely different environment with an entirely different starting collection of stuff. And it evolves in a different way from what we're used to on Earth. Because on Earth, you know, we live in this oxygen-poisoned, water-saturated environment. And this is really the only place in the solar system where that happens. So everywhere else is going to be different. It's going to be different in some fairly predictable ways. Right. But the problem is that people quite often don't think about those ways and don't test in those ways. And that's what is important for what Exolith does. Is to test realistically and test hard and find out what fails and what doesn't.
What is this synthetic moon dust made of specifically?
Well, minerals are minerals. Same as on the moon or Mars. What happens is you just get a different collection of minerals from what you're used to in most locations on Earth. So most of the moon is made of a mineral called an anorthosite. What you do is you mix your simulant for the terrain that you're interested in simulating. For most of the moon, particularly the south pole of the moon where people are interested in exploring, it's mostly an anorthosite. So our simulant is about 70% an anorthosite, about 25% basalt, and the other 5% a pinch of this and a dash of that.
And how long does it take to make moon dust?
Well, on the moon, it takes millions of years. Because what you're doing is you're making it grain by grain from little dust hitting it at 20 or 30 kilometers a second. Here, we make it by the ton. So we can make 2 or 3 tons a week. Right now, they're working on a big order, so they're going to be busy for the next couple of months.
That's great. What are you hoping for the future of this lab?
Well, we have a number of challenges. One of the things that we like to do is get more people in here to use our test facilities. We have a large regolith bin, 10 by 10 meters. So we need more customers to use it for testing their instruments and their hardware and their rovers. Those are the things that we're focused on right now. I try to develop business and try to educate students as much as possible in how extraterrestrial materials work. It's not that hard. It's just that people don't run into such things on a daily basis, which is why we do these simulants.
Daniel, thank you so much for having me come here and have the opportunity to see this.
Well, thanks for coming, and it's always a pleasure to host you.
That was our intern Ashley Reap speaking with Dan Britt, a Pegasus professor of physics at the University of Central Florida and director of the Exolith Lab. The 12 people that walked on the moon brought back some moon dust and got to keep a bit of it. That includes Alan Bean, who used his in his art. Back in 1969, Alan Bean became the fourth person to ever walk on the moon during the Apollo 12 mission. After his retirement, Bean focused on art, and he befriended another astronaut-turned-artist, Nicole Stott. She's a veteran NASA astronaut and co-founder of the Space for Art Foundation and joins us to talk about Bean's art and their friendship. Nicole, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Yeah, great to have you. It's always fun to talk art with you, but I want to talk about one of the arts friends you met along the way, moonwalker Alan Bean, who's also an artist. Tell me a bit about how you two crossed paths.
The way I actually met him, of course, through the astronaut office. He was not in the office actively anymore when I joined in, and I can't believe it, 25 years ago in 2000, but he still had a presence there and was in Houston and came to some of the, you know, kind of the introductory meetings we had as an astronaut class. And he, of course, came to some of the reunions that would go on. We do one of those every couple of years. It was just a real pleasure to meet him. He just had this kind of joyful presence about him. And I'd like to believe that had to do with, you know, walking on the moon and doing those kinds of things. But I also think it really came from this like artistic spirit that he had. Long story short, the way I met him, like really got to know him, was when I was getting ready to retire in 2015. Anna Fisher, you know, Anna, one of the, you know, the very first women astronauts at NASA, she knew him quite well. And she felt like it was important that I meet him. And so she arranged for me to go visit him at his studio in Houston. And it just kind of went from there. And I am so grateful to have him as a mentor, you know, on the space side, but more in this kind of transition from space to art and how that can be just a really fulfilling part of your life.
Had he always had that knack for art?
Well, he certainly picked it up in earnest when he retired, but I think he always had it. I can't remember when he started painting, but he studied, you know, whether that was on his own or in a class kind of setting, he studied art as well. And, you know, he was certainly inspired in a really wonderful way by Monet. Once you know it, you're like, oh my gosh, yeah. When you look at his paintings, because they have those pinks and purples and kind of colors that you would never really necessarily associate with the moon in them. And I think that's where he took his artistic license. He was like an engineer of art, like meticulous about the detail of lighting and scale. And other than that color kind of thing that he brought into it with that Monet influence, I mean, he was really meticulous about the kind of engineering side of the art process as well.
I'm looking at some images of his photos through a brand new lens now after you've told me about that Monet influence. And yeah, you can absolutely see the kind of engineering influence as well with the shading and the reflections.
You know how he did the boot prints in the paintings? He had like a pair of training, you know, the boot covers, and he would put those imprints into the paintings. And he had this series of like boot print sized palettes with a boot print in it and all different kinds of paletted colors of the grays and the pinks and the blues and stuff in it. I mean, I told him, I'm like, that would be a wonderful series to just sell as a collection.
Yeah.
But it was just his trial runs of what that boot print would look like, how he should color it, the way the paint should be. It was so cool.
I'm reading a quote from him, and it says, quote, "But I'm the only one who can paint the moon because I'm the only one who knows whether that's right or not." I love that.
He said that, you know, it was very, very matter of fact about being the one from the moon who could do that, right? But in speaking to him, I know his hope, honestly, was that more people would have the opportunity to do that, right? As we go forward and we, you know, put those steps and presence back on the moon, I know he was very hopeful that this storytelling, you know, whether it's through a painting or music or whatever it might be, could come through those people that were experiencing it too.
Along with bringing that kind of engineering spirit to his paintings, he physically brought the moon to some of his paintings, right? Using lunar dust. Did he ever talk to you about that and how that process came to be and what it's like even painting with moon dust?
He wanted the paintings to have a special connection to the moon, you know, not just through him being the artist that created them, but by really bringing the moon to the painting. So when you look at his paintings, there's a really cool elevation to that because he does put these boot prints into them. You know, the Apollo guys had the chance to actually have some of the stuff that they had on the moon with them that they brought back. So he has this really cool hammer that he used on the moon that he'll put, you know, he put these like circular hammer marks into the paint. And
oh,
then
wow.
The thing that I think made it really special, like you mentioned, this moon dust aspect was that he wasn't, you know, it's not like he had a jar of moon dust and was sprinkling it into the painting. It was very, I don't know, integrated in kind of a cool way. And in his studio, he had this, you know, imagine kind of one of those frames that's like a picture box, you know, you can open it and close it and you can put stuff in it, collectible kind of thing. And he had his patches from his suit and some fabric from his suit that was on the moon. And to put the moon dust in his paintings, he would pull off like just little threads of those patches that were sealed in this box to, you know, contain it all. And that was the way that the moon dust would get into the painting. So he wasn't really painting with the moon dust, but he was almost kind of like a mixed media thing, you know, incorporating these tiny little pieces of moon dust soaked, if you will, string into the paintings.
A string that had been on the moon as well.
Yeah, actual patches and fabric that were on his suit.
That is so intentional and it really does tie those images back to the moon. I mean, Nicole, there are so few people that have been to space, you and Alan included. And of that very small population, very, very few of you have taken up art afterwards. And I noticed that the two of you also have a lot of similarities as well as both engineers, both artists, both have been to space. In the time you got to spend with Alan, what did you learn from him? What did you take away and how does that influence your art?
Oh my gosh, there was this spirit to the man that just, it kind of just gets in you, right? I think one of the things I took away was like this real inspiration and encouragement. When I was retiring, I was questioning a little bit this idea of using art as a way to extend on this experience I'd had in space, right? Like really in my heart, I believed that art was going to be this wonderful way to not only share what we're doing in space, it's all about life on Earth and all of these ways to engage communities that might not have any idea what we're doing, but to have purpose other ways, right? And, you know, like what we've done through Space for Art and these other things. I mean, that wouldn't have come for me without the space and art coming together. And he was very clearly, intentionally, just wonderfully this guy who had already done that and showed me how when we do pay attention to these things that are in us somehow, kind of innate, that beautiful things can happen as a result of it. And man, there, you know, I would call him or I have a saved message on my voicemail. I really miss the man. And that was him just calling me one day because he knew I was working on some kind of painting. And he's like, oh, Nicole, I really think if you use this kind of brush, it would work with that visor thing you're doing. And whatever it was. I mean, it was just like, oh my gosh. And so he latched on to this love of art as an extension of what he had done in space in a very purposeful way. And it made him happy. And I think it made other people happy. And so I try to take that from him, especially when I'm kind of questioning, you know, there are points in times where I'm questioning, oh my gosh, what am I doing? You know, how am I doing this? Hopefully it's helpful to somebody else. And I'm very grateful to him for that and for his friendship, getting to know his wife, Leslie. And it's just been a really wonderful thing.
Nicole Stott is a veteran NASA astronaut and co-founder of the Space for Art Foundation. She's also the author of Back to Earth, What Life in Space Taught Me About Our Home Planet and Our Mission to Protect It. Nicole, always a pleasure to chat with you. Thanks for sharing your insight.
You too. Thank you.
Still to come, exploring the moon's south pole. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. Kids ask the best questions. That's why we're turning the mic over to our younger listeners so they can ask an astronaut their burning space questions. As part of our Curious Space segment, we'll ask veteran NASA astronaut Winston Scott to answer questions from kids about his time in space. That's on a future episode of Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about a new moon mission with Firefly Aerospace. NASA has awarded Firefly over $170 million to deliver 5 payloads to the lunar surface. It's part of NASA's Commercial Lunar Payload Services Program, or CLPS. The mission is scheduled for sometime in 2029, and will explore and research the moon's south pole. We're here to talk more about Firefly's future missions is Kevin Schulte, the future systems architect at Firefly Aerospace. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, so some exciting news coming to your organization, Firefly, with a NASA award of over $170 million to get some payloads to the moon. Before we talk about the payloads and what goes into making that happen, let's first start by talking about the mission. Where is this heading on the moon?
This is our fourth mission, and this will be the first one for Firefly headed towards the South Pole. We're getting pretty close to the South Pole, about 86 degrees from the equator, and this will be on the rim of a crater called Hayworth, which where we're positioned is about 6 kilometers from the base of the crater. So it seems a little bit high up. So we'll be looking over a large landscape. And in fact, I think on the horizon, we'll even be able to see the actual South Pole at Shackleton Crater.
Oh, wow. That'll be really cool. I've got to imagine that heading to the South Pole of the moon adds a little bit of additional challenges to the orbital mechanics and also landing and surviving on the moon. Tell me a bit about the South Pole region itself and what you've had to think about when planning this mission.
It's easy to think of the moon from a mission planning standpoint in sort of three major regions, the near side, the far side, and the South Pole. Each of them have their own unique challenges. What's unique about the South Pole is mostly that the sun and the earth, you know, rarely ever get very high above the horizon. In fact, during large portions of the year, they might not be visible at all. So much like you have with the Arctic Circle here on planet Earth, you'll have periods of time in which the sun is perpetually above the horizon, periods where it's perpetually below the horizon. And then the same thing with the moon. And then on top of that, the moon does what we call libration, where it sort of oscillates back and forth. So parts of the moon that can see the Earth will change over time seasonally. So for this particular mission, we're schedule constrained because the seasonal window for where we're landing lasts only about 3 months. So if we don't land within those 3 months, we have to delay the mission by at least a year for the next seasonal window where all the pointing is aligned. Otherwise, landing at the South Pole isn't that much different from landing anywhere else on the moon. The fact that the sun isn't getting very high in the sky doesn't really change the conditions, because when we land elsewhere on the moon, the sun is similarly at a low elevation at the time of landing so that we can maximize our daylight hours. Mostly the difference that you'll see in the South Pole is that it tends to be rockier terrain. It's, you know, mostly what's called highlands terrain. So lots of sort of mountainous regions, big, deep craters. So there are fewer locations that are accessible for landing, but the quality of the landing sites themselves are pretty comparable.
With those challenges of the landing site, you know, that limited time for solar power, you've got that rocky terrain. Why go there in the first place? What's so exciting about the South Pole, and why are these agencies sending missions there?
There's a whole manifold of reasons to get excited about the South Pole for science and for human exploration. In many ways, the South Pole represents an incredible time capsule for the solar system. We believe that there are ancient deposits of volatile gases and water underneath the surface. And those are just like taking ice cores from Antarctica. Those are incredible records dating back hundreds of millions of years on the solar system. So there's a lot that NASA scientists can learn from the South Pole, you know, and missions that are associated with that. And then from a human exploration standpoint, you know, I just mentioned that there's potentially, you know, water at the South Pole. So missions like this one, while, you know, we're focused on delivering a manifest rather than achieving specific scientific goals, missions like this one pave the way for understanding what the actual mineral resources are at the South Pole, because if we're ever going to have a permanent sustained presence on the moon, we're going to need water for those pesky humans that need a lot of care and feeding.
Those pesky lunar humans, huh? Let's talk a bit about the mission itself. From Earth to the moon, how is Firefly going to get these two rovers and these three scientific experiments from our planet to the surface of the moon? What does that look like?
The basic approach, we use a similar approach as we did on our Blue Ghost Mission 1 that we successfully landed earlier this year, where we take a slightly longer transit time than you might expect. You know, there's sort of direct injects that'll get you to the moon in a few short days. We take a more leisurely route that, you know, can take about 30 days to get there. This has advantages in that it saves us some propellant, it saves us some mass because we use the moon's gravity to help pull on our orbit a little bit. The main advantage, though, is that it gives us incredible shakedown time with the hardware so that the operations team, by the time of these super critical tasks and operations, are already very sharp, already in tune with the machine that they're operating, and have already addressed any kind of emergent issues that might have come up during the mission. So that's the approach of getting there. And then in terms of landing on the surface, you know, we use a terrain relative navigation where, just like pilots looking out a window with their eyes, you know, we're looking at the surface of the moon with a vision navigation system and high density compute to look at the moon and match it to what our onboard model of the moon says the moon should look like to tell us where we are and give us direction on where to land, and then help us identify hazards on the surface. And then once we're on the surface, you know, we touch down and we've got these two rovers. We're carrying them on board and we deploy them with our own developed deployer mechanisms. And then after they are on the surface, it's mostly our job to serve as a relay station for them so that they can get communications back to Earth.
And how big is the lander? Just remind our listeners about what the actual vehicle size is that will touch down on the lunar surface.
Our lunar lander is a little bit shorter than 2 meters nominally. You know, you could expect that, you know, your typical adult standing next to the lander, that's about how tall our lander is. But, you know, in terms of size and width, you know, this is comparable to like a Volkswagen Bug. Like it's a sizable object. And, you know, we're coming in, you know, somewhere north of a half a metric ton of the dry mass for the lander itself. And closer to a couple metric tons for the total mass of everything on board.
And let's talk a bit about what is going to be in this lander for this mission. There's two rovers, right? One is a micro rover. How tiny is that in comparison to your standard rover?
Yeah, it's definitely on the smaller size of what you might expect when you think of NASA rovers like Curiosity or Perseverance, which are, you know, sort of like, those are sort of the size of a Jeep, really. And this is going to be much more closer to, you know, like a professional RC car. Like this will be a piece of luggage you might take on an airplane is sort of the scale of that rover for Moon Ranger. Similarly, there's another rover called the Canadian Space Agency rover, which is a little bit larger than that one. Running with the metaphor there, a large piece of check-on luggage probably, and that'll sit on the top of the vehicle before we lower it to the surface on an arm.
And that's kind of the beauty of Blue Ghost platform, right? You can really adapt it to whatever the customer's need is to get things to the moon, right?
In my opinion, that's the beauty of the CLPS program in general, is the concept of converting these missions to services rather than necessarily a traditional mission, where what we're providing to NASA is manifest space and the interface for their manifests, as opposed to a dedicated custom vehicle. This gives us huge advantages in terms of reducing the cost for space exploration, as well as creating opportunities for payloads that might not otherwise be able to fly. And we're working slowly over time to do what we can to standardize interfaces. But, you know, there is a fair amount of customization that we have to do each time, just because some payloads want to get on the surface. Some payloads just want to be up high to have a good perch to look from. Other payloads just want everything to be very nice and quiet. So there is some level of customization we have to do each time, but the flexibility of a service mission is pretty incredible.
And CLPS stands for Commercial Lunar Payload Services, right?
Correct.
Kevin, let's talk about your last successful landing. You know, you mentioned at the start of our conversation that this mission is kind of taking the same approach, that kind of long coast to the moon before landing. What else did you learn from that successful mission that you're applying to this upcoming one?
There's a veritable fire hose of things to learn from that first mission. The moon is unique in space missions, in terms of space missions, because of how demanding the surface environment is and how limited the access time is. You know, as we can all appreciate, you know, the phases of the moon take a month to go through. But from the perspective of someone on the surface of the moon, that means you get 2 weeks of daylight for most locations of the moon, followed by 2 weeks of total darkness. So you get 2 weeks to complete an entire mission that you've been working on for 4 years, or at least the surface portion of it. So there are massive lessons learned there in terms of what we learned about operations and the integration of the teams between the Firefly team and the payload teams and the ground station teams, all sorts of communications refinement that we did during the mission, part of the value of having that long transit period, you know, getting our uptime on accessibility to our ground stations up was huge. I think one of the biggest lessons learned coming out of that mission, though, was probably just the refreshing what we would call stale data from the 1960s. So we had lots of data from the Apollo era about the moon, but not a lot of more recent data to base our assessments on what the environments were like. So we did our best based on the best resources available to us, the best resources available to NASA, to predict what the thermal environment looked like on the moon. But when we got down there, it turned out to be a lot hotter than we were expecting and a lot earlier than we were expecting it to be hot. And we found out that there were phenomenon and scenarios that were not anticipated. You know, in our particular case, we landed next to a crater that had a large sort of dish shape to it and was reflecting light back onto us, which increased the amount of heating we're having much higher than we were expecting. And on that first mission, we also had the wonderful opportunity, the cosmic alignment, to get to witness an eclipse from the surface of the moon. And if you've ever seen an eclipse in person on Earth, you know, you'll understand that, you know, witnessing an eclipse in person, you'll feel the temperature drop about 10 degrees as the sun gets covered up by the moon. Well, on the moon, there's no atmosphere to blanket that. So the temperature doesn't drop 10 degrees. It drops 500 degrees. It's a pretty extreme drop and very rapid. So we get a very nice preview of what surviving into the night has to look like in the future.
And every mission success builds on the next mission. So hoping for a very successful next mission, Kevin. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us and sharing about what's to come for Firefly Aerospace's lunar exploration.
Thank you for having me.
That was Kevin Schultes, the future systems architect at Firefly Aerospace. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, NPR's app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. Our handle is at @AWTYSpace on Instagram and Facebook. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Our intern this semester has been Ashley Reap. Ashley, thanks for a great semester and best of luck in your future at Astra. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.